from the advertising media capital of the world, New Milford, Connecticut, wherever that is. This is Mostly Marketing with Matt Wilson.
Oh, hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Mostly Marketing with Matt Wilson, presented by Silverback Advertising. Also, quick note, thank you to Jim McCarthy from JimMcCarthyVoiceovers.com for my super fancy, cool intro. Buddy of mine, he can do your intros too. Find him online, JimMcCarthyVoiceovers.com. In today's episode, we are going to talk about Greek philosophy. What? You're not that smart, Matt. What do you mean? Trust me, there'll be a tie-in here. I'm assuming that you're all familiar with Aristotle, right? You know, born in Greece, 384 BC. I knew that information before this morning. The guy put words and names to different scientific disciplines, contributed to mathematics, logic, biology, all things that I learned in high school, but forgot and then relearned this morning. And so we're going to tie this into the ethics of AI, right? AI's got a huge impact all over the world. I know that I use it on a probably regular basis in my job, but we want to talk about it on more of a broad scale and its impact across sectors and industries and how we should think about it as a whole. You know, we've been talking about it a lot on the show, and we experiment with it at Silverback. We actually use it for this podcast, right? We write all the podcast summaries and the descriptions and the social posts using AI, whether it's Claude or Bard or ChatGPT or whatever. You know, we'll make graphics using Midjourney, and we use it to an extent at the agency for a bunch of things as well. But I think the question is, what does it mean for all of us in business, in life, in the country? And these are all questions that are far above my pay grade and education level. So I think what we'll do is we'll bring in an expert, right? That's what you got to do. You got to bring in someone smarter than you to, better teach you what is going on. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to bring in Jeff Schaefer. He's the head of responsible AI at Booz Allen Hamilton. Do I have that right?
Yes, sir.
All right.
How's it going, Matt? Good to be with you.
Going well. Welcome to the podcast. I think it's going well so far. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I'm disappointed you forgot a bunch of stuff from high school. I don't know who does that. So
I always, and you know, in my brain, I feel like it was only 10 years ago, but it turns out it was way longer than that. You know, you're like, oh wait, that was 20 years ago? Wait, 22 years ago?
It was an epoch.
Yeah, I don't remember anything I learned in Spanish class either. Just for clarification.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, I didn't have the most sterling of GPAs, so we're in good stead.
All right. Well, good to know. I don't feel so bad now. This is such a broad topic that I almost don't know like where to start with you, because it's a broad, wide-ranging topic. So I guess let's start as basic as possible for people listening who have been hearing the buzzword, it's really letters, the buzz acronym thrown around a lot recently, but in years as well. So at its most basic form, tell the people, what is AI?
So what most folks are going to hear about and be experiencing in their daily lives right now, or as of just over a year ago with ChatGPT being released, is generative AI. And generative AI is really interesting. There's a few different versions of it. Most people have come across what are called LLMs, large language models. There are also diffusion models. You mentioned Midjourney in your opening. So the models that create images are called diffusion models. And now we have multimodal models, which is exactly as it sounds. It combines, you know, text, images, sensory data, thermal data, all sorts of data types. It combines them to do a specific set of tasks that require all of those different modes. And so ChatGPT started as an LLM, and now with GPT-4 and other similar types of models from other companies, they are increasingly multimodal. And so we can increasingly use them to do a whole range of tasks that feel very intuitive to us. And that is sort of the holy grail of where the field is trying to get to.
Tell us a couple, give us a couple of examples of, I guess good is not the right word, but a couple of things, good things that it can do. And then we'll talk about harm.
So I am an AI optimist, and I think people are surprised by that, as someone who is responsible for responsible AI. But when I look at all of the things that AI is already doing in the hard sciences and how much the hard sciences then impact our daily lives for the better, I am overwhelmingly excited. And so, you know, from physics to chemistry to biology, I think we're on the precipice of the next sort of scientific renaissance. And there are all sorts of examples, but I turn off into DeepMind's AlphaFold system, where it helped crack the 50-year challenge in biology of protein folding, which will have all sorts of downstream impact on medicine, precision diagnostics, et cetera, which will help human flourishing, which we'll come back to, I assume, when we start talking about Aristotle. They also released a new system called Alpha MySense, which is designed to help advance material science. And it's already discovered new materials that we never knew about. And material science has all sorts of impact across disciplines, from the clothes we wear to the cars we drive, et cetera. And so we have systems that are controlling fusion reactors to get us a little bit closer to the promise of fusion. It's helping us understand the laws of physics better. So it's immensely exciting. And when we do each one of those things a little bit better, we have all sorts of, again, downstream impacts to the daily lives that we have. Gen AI promises to simply accelerate all of those things.
I think what you just said is important, because it's not just for like cheating on college essays, right? Like, there's a much larger impact and scale. And maybe for people who don't understand the thing you were saying about like the protein fold, like I don't think people think of it on that scale, right? They're thinking about like, you know, the layperson, practical applications, writing your resume, writing copy, cheating on college essay, asking it questions that, you know, you can get an answer to quicker than trying to do your own research or read up on it. Or so so talking about it on that larger level, having such a large impact across humanity, I guess, let's talk about responsible AI, because there's harm. Also, optimist, I like that. That's a good, that's nice to hear, because you would think somebody who's involved in the responsibility and the ethics of it would be on the pessimistic side, like, whoa, guys, let's watch out here. But like, what kind of things are you watching for, and what's the harm that can be done?
Well, I mean, to connect the two points here, going back to Aristotle, so the classic philosophers were not as concerned with the question or the difference between right and wrong as we may assume. They were, but really their major focus was, what does it mean to live a good life? Aristotle called this eudaimonia, which roughly translates into human flourishing and happiness. So if you really take a historical, like massively historical view of ethics, mm-hmm. It is not just the things that we should not do, you know, the things that are wrong and that we know are wrong and the reasons why we know they're wrong and don't want to do those things, but it's also maximizing flourishing and human happiness. And so one of the reasons why I'm an optimist is because I look at both of those dimensions. I see all sorts of upside potential for AI to advance human flourishing. And then there are all sorts of, you know, attendant risks. But another reason why I'm an optimist is because the work that the field of responsible AI is doing right now is so we can accelerate our understanding of what those risks are, how we might better control for them, mitigate them, et cetera, such that we can fulfill the promise of AI and sort of protect that potential versus letting this thing run rampant and have all sorts of risks manifest in ways that we weren't predicting, that we can't control, et cetera. So I think, you know, one of the reasons why I'm an optimist is because you have to balance risk and reward, just like you have to do in any industry for anything. And I think on the whole, we're getting better and better at understanding the different ways that AI systems produce kind of unique risk and not so unique risk, yeah, and all sorts of ways, therefore, we can better govern these systems. So one of the things that I think about is, and this is not necessarily a specific risk or explicit downside, but it is a thing. So there's this, you know, concept called emergent behavior. And generative AI systems are really interesting and they produce a lot of emergent behavior. So what is that? When you have a complex system doing complex things, it will produce behaviors or outputs or outcomes that you can't, by definition, predict ahead of time. And so a good example of this is GPT. It was not trained explicitly to code a video game, but because of the way it was trained, on basically the entirety of the world's data, and because of the way these systems operate, one of the emergent behaviors, i.e. the things it can do, a capability that it has that we didn't predict ahead of time, is you can ask it to code a video game for you. And a number of folks have done this, you know, very simple games, of course,
right,
at least right now, but it works. And so that's an emergent property of how these systems work. And so you can imagine all sorts of emergent properties and capabilities that are good, useful, helpful, and exciting. And you can imagine all sorts of emergent properties that are on the other side of that scale. So I worry about our ability to understand these emergent capabilities with enough lead time to do something about them and with enough creativity on the field's part to figure out how to control for those things.
Yeah, so that's, control is interesting. So are there rules and regulations as to, so we discovered that it can code a video game, but if we discover that it can, other things that it can do, good or bad, like where's the regulation of, nope, this is too far?
So one of the challenges of AI policy and regulation is, particularly when it comes to these more advanced systems, with these emergent properties, is we don't know these things and what they're going to do and how they're going to behave in all of the different ways and all of the different scenarios ahead of time. And so one of the things that we talk about a lot is the best way to understand and therefore control and mitigate the risks of an AI system is to maximally engage with that system. So the more we use these systems in our daily lives across different industries and sectors and jobs, the more we're going to understand their unique behaviors and what triggers those unique behaviors. And that will allow us to have more tailored policies and interventions and even technical controls to basically mitigate the behaviors that we don't want those systems to have. And so in some ways, you know, things like the executive order from the administration back in November, the OMB implementation guidance that followed on the heels of the EO, the EU AI Act. These policies are attempting to kind of set a baseline set of guardrails around these technologies. And I think by and large, these approaches make sense, are good, and are going to have, a good impact. But really, the devil is in the details. The Jesuits call this descending into the particulars. And so the more we get into the specifics of how a specific AI system operates in a specific use case, the more we can have the requisite context and specificity to understand, again, what will trigger the behaviors and the outputs that we don't want, and therefore how we can control for those things. So to sort of wrap that up, policy's tough, because once you get past the baseline level of policy and regulatory guardrails, it really gets into nuanced behaviors very quickly, and you can't write a policy for every situation, every use case through time. in advance. You have to let these systems be used throughout different industries and sectors, and we have to learn. And as we learn, then we can design more effective policy interventions where it makes sense to.
So there must be difficulty. It's an ever-changing, ever-evolving world. So there must be great difficulty in keeping up with it for you guys.
It's Matt, my job is both phenomenal and overwhelming. It is daunting. It is, responsible AI touches every type of AI system. You know, we're talking mostly about generative, and most of the field right now is focused on generative, but there are all sorts of different AI systems, from specific computer vision systems to classic reinforcement learning systems. So we have to have kind of our pulse on all of these different types of AI. We have to have a pulse on how these AI systems are being used across different industries. And Booz Allen is mostly focused on the federal government. And so how the different agencies are using these systems, what their strategies are calling for, what their missions are, therefore the different ways that AI could and should be used to advance those missions, et cetera. And then we have to understand all of the different controls, techniques, approaches, et cetera, that we have today that are effective or are not effective, and all of the things that we need to build tomorrow. So the field is being built and shaped in real time, which is extremely exciting and is probably the only approach that is realistic given how quickly things are moving. But that just means that every day feels like we're in a full out sprint, and the amount of newsletters, podcasts, books, articles, et cetera, that I should be reading is just impossible.
Yeah. The regulators can't possibly be up to date on all of the information and knowledge that you and the folks at Booz Allen are up to date on. So there's a lot of effort going into educating up, essentially, before those regulations and can be put in place.
I think a lot of the community, and I use that term broadly, the developers of these AI systems, folks like us at Booz Allen, who also develop some of these systems, but integrate and then, put into place different responsible AI practices, et cetera. Policymakers themselves, heads of agencies, now after the executive order, chief AI officers, the community is kind of coming together in a unique way. Everyone is starting to learn that they need one another, and that each sort of actor or stakeholder in that community ecosystem has a unique role to play and has unique information that can contribute to this broader understanding of where we're at, where we need to go, and what are the risks and opportunities to get from here to there. So we do, we educate up, we are educated ourselves, and we spend a lot of time trying to engage with industry and with our peers and colleagues across different industries in and outside of the government, so that we're learning, we're contributing, and we're sort of all advancing together. There's really no other way to do it at this point.
Now we're talking about the positive side of it, but there's got to be a part of the responsible AI that goes into trying to prevent the negative side of it. How do you guys have a list somewhere where it's like, all right, here's the things we have to watch out for. Here's the 10 things we're freaked out about. Like, how do you determine what you don't know what's possible, right? How do you kind of keep all that in a, straight in your mind?
Well, we actually sort of literally do have a list. Okay. I'll actually come back to that in a second. But, one of the things that was an outcome of what we were just talking about is OMB and their implementation guide for the executive order has listed out a number of rights and safety impacting categories, basically scenarios by which an AI will impact a human right, a personal and individual right, or some sort of aspect of safety, whether it's part of our critical infrastructure, transportation, et cetera. So in some ways, the community is converging on a list of just sort of core things that no matter what, we don't want AI to break or to do harm to, et cetera. But past that sort of baseline level, this gets back into what I was saying earlier about the context and specificity. So we have this really unique risk and impact assessment that we call the ethical ATO. Stands for authority to operate, which is a sort of a approach in IT and cybersecurity and elsewhere that basically does a really rigorous analysis of a system or piece of IT equipment to find all of its holes, vulnerabilities, risks, et cetera, and basically seeks to patch those things up so that we can put it into production and we can use it without worrying about it breaking on us or going sideways. So we thought there was a similar approach that we should take for responsible AI. That's how we came up with this assessment. And what we learned early on when we started using it in 2020 was each AI system is really different. They're unique the way they're being used across different use cases, whether it's a military application, a back office application, marketing, et cetera. Even if it's the same system, the use of it is going to change its parameters, dimensions, functions, capabilities. And therefore, we need to look at each one of those instances in its own unique way. And so as we've started doing that, we realized sort of as a validation of that, that the considerations, what we call the key ethical considerations, and each of those use cases were really different and unique from others. There was some commonality for sure, and some of the recommendations that we pulled together are common for sure. But each time we do one of those assessments, we learn new things. We learn new ways that an AI system could produce risk or produce behaviors that would be suboptimal and that we want to control for. And so that goes literally on a list. And every now and then we sort of zoom out, step back and look for, like I said, commonalities, how we might connect those dots and what we can learn more broadly across this AI ecosystem as we're doing these individual risk assessments that we might be able to extract and design controls for that could be applied more broadly. So it's this constant, I don't want to say tension, but tension in sort of a neutral way, tension between the specific and the general. And we're going to learn things in that general category by doing specific things and vice versa. And so there's a good sort of symbiotic relationship between looking at AI broadly and then looking at how it's being used in very specific instances.
Yeah, no pressure, but you're in charge of keeping the world safe, really. So you're doing
good work. Yeah, not a lot of pressure.
No pressure at all. How does the responsible AI industry, guys that do what you do and what Booz Allen does, look at the, okay, Aristotle laid out all these things. Like, who makes the decision? This is ethical. This is not ethical. Like, what's the process? How does that happen? Because it's so ambiguous.
Yeah. Well, so in some ways it's, it's relative, ethics are going to be defined, by an organization or a company or a set of individuals. And it's going to look different in different instances. And so, the DoD has their 5 ethical principles. Individual companies are increasingly developing their own ethical principles, and that is sort of their moral compass. That is the thing by which they will anchor to and determine, at least at a first approximation, what is ethical, what is not. So one of the things, again, that we sort of learned by doing with these ethical ATO assessments is, you learn what might be an ethical, not necessarily risk or harm, but at least an ethical consideration by getting into the details of the system and the use case again. So we're often surprised by things that sort of pop out of those assessments. Maybe those are consistent with the ethical principles that the organization has. Maybe they're not. Maybe it's a new consideration entirely. Sort of ethics is evolving. Ethics is not static, and ethics is particular to the organization, the individual, and what they want to define as their sort of left and right boundary on what is acceptable or not. Another way we approach this is, you know, we often got the question of what's the difference between ethical AI and responsible AI? And at first we thought, oh, they're interchangeable. There's really no meaningful difference, but we kept getting asked that question. And, you know, so we thought about it a bit more deeply, and we realized that ethics is actually just a part of it. Mm-hmm. So we came up with what we call our regs formula, which is responsible AI equals ethics plus governance plus safety. And it's those three variables, those three components that together make up an AI system that we could classify as responsible. And we talk about that equation as being balanced differently in different situations. And so you could imagine a facial recognition AI system, the ethics of that when used to unlock our phones are very different than when used in surveillance systems.
Right.
The governance of those, of the technology behind the scenes may actually be the same. It may be very similar, very simple, but the safety in those two different use cases is going to be fundamentally different as well. So the safety and the ethics will change greatly. The governance may stay the same. And you can imagine all sorts of different AI systems used in different cases for, you know, biology synthesis or chemical synthesis. You know, the ethics of that for medicine that helps you is going to be different than medicine or biological weapons, for example. Yeah. So that's why we thought this formula was actually really useful, because no matter what an organization, what their ethical principles are, we can use this formula to help really understand the balance of the ethics and the governance and safety concerns, and how we might tailor each one of those things for the desired outcomes.
Is the world of responsible AI and ethical AI a very collaborative world, or is it like we're doing this, they're doing this, like, or is it one happy kumbaya family?
It's an interesting question. It is becoming more kumbaya-ish, or at least kumbaya adjacent.
kumbaya adjacent. Those are the first time those words have been used on this podcast, just so you know.
I think maybe ever. It's really interesting. So the field actually has, despite it being very dynamic right now and very early, it really has been around for a while. And you'll have, I don't want to say different factions, but different camps of folks that have different interests in like approaches to solve some of the specific problems in the field. So there's a camp that is really focused on, you know, things like bias, fairness, transparency. There's a camp that is focused on, you know, long-term risks versus the short-term risks that we're facing now. Et cetera, et cetera. And so we're seeing an interesting sort of push and pull, you know, a convergence of some of those communities and a divergence of some of those communities. But I think increasingly the field broadly is realizing that this stuff is hard, it's moving quickly, and we should probably have more convergence than we should, you know, remain in our individual camps and circles. And so one of the things that we're trying to do at Booz Allen is actually fuse those camps together more and more, because each one has really unique things to offer. Everyone has sort of a Venn diagram of issues that we need to solve together and care about. And that Venn diagram has more overlap than I think some of the folks in the community may realize we do. And so, again, AI optimist here. I'm optimistic that over the next couple years, we're going to see quite a lot of convergence, and we're trying to do our part to make that happen.
I'm thinking about this example from earlier in my life. When I worked in radio, I was involved with St. Jude Children's Research Hospital through like fundraising efforts. And we a bunch of radio people went down there and toured the hospital and did a bunch of seminars and met the patients and met the doctors. And one of the things that they talk about when you go down there is their their willingness to share their research and information with other hospitals. People will say, oh, well, I'm going to donate money to St. Jude and they're going to take care of one patient and this patient's family. But the things that they discover and the things that they understand in their lab, they push that information out to other hospitals, whether it's your local hospital or cancer research centers or groups. And I think as a lay person, a regular citizen, I think that we, and having been affected by cancer in my immediate family, we like that. Like, we want those groups to share information and work together. So I speak for not the country, but maybe for my neighborhood, that yes, we would like you all to work together and be more than kumbaya adjacent.
That, first of all, I'm sorry to hear that. I hope your family's doing better.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I also completely agree with that. I mean, that's exactly right. You know, there are things across the community that we're going to need to solve together. And it sounds sort of cheesy, but right. Each one of us brings sort of unique expertise to the table. And it's the combination of that that's going to get us, you know, down the field. And there needs to be a level of creativity to stitch these different ideas and approaches together that we can't achieve, you know, individually. And given how fast the field is developing, you know, again, overwhelmingly fast, We have no choice but to create a situation where 1 + 1 = 3.
Okay, we spent 30 minutes on the serious stuff. Can we talk about the less serious stuff now?
Let's do it.
Do you have an Aristotle tattoo or a bust of Aristotle anywhere in your home?
No tattoo. It's not a bad idea. A bust right is also not a bad idea. Yeah, right here, probably right arm. But plenty of books on the shelf.
Where are you from?
I was born in Leonardtown, Maryland, St. Mary's County, by the base Pax River. My dad was a Navy civilian at that time. And so I was born there, quickly moved to Virginia. And I've been in Virginia, you know, sort of off and on my entire life. I did college in West Virginia at WVU. I lived in New York City for a number of years. But now I'm back home in Virginia, about 5 minutes from Dulles Airport.
Safe to say you're from Maryland. You like Old Bay, I imagine, right? Old Bay seasoning.
Especially on wings.
On wings, really?
Oh, my goodness. Old Bay dry rub, Matt.
On wings?
On wings. I promise you, if you have an air fryer, get some Old Bay, put it on some chicken wings, air fry it up. And I promise you.
Old Bay wings. I do have an air fryer. I love my air fryer.
So do I.
Interesting. I was looking at your LinkedIn profile this morning, 20 minutes before the episode, because I know how to do prep, you know, right at the last minute. And I saw that you used to be an officer at the Federal Reserve.
That's right.
Have you ever seen a big pile of gold anywhere?
Yeah, literally. Yes. Underneath the Federal Reserve Bank. So
does it smell? Does it have like a good smell to it? you know, that's the stupidest questions ever, but
I don't remember if it smelled or not. You can go, so they do tours.
Really?
There's an elevator that takes you down pretty deep into the Manhattan bedrock.
That doesn't seem smart.
And there is a huge vault down there full of quite a bit of the world's gold. And the reason why it's there is because before we went off the gold standard, that was, you know, literally our medium of exchange. And unsurprisingly, they realized it was not super practical to be shifting gold bars back and forth across the globe countries were doing transactions with one another. And so that is one of the reasons why we have this sort of a accounting system that we have now, which is, you know, a sophisticated equivalent of IOUs. And so, you know, in the ledger, it's like, okay, England, we have, you know, 90 of your gold bars. We promise if you actually literally want them one day, we will give them to you. But for now, do you mind if we just keep them and we can?
Yeah, they're really heavy. We don't want to put them in the elevator. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the old cartoons where what's his name would jump up and down on a diving board and then like land in a big pool of gold coin. That doesn't exist, right?
Not that I know of. Okay. Not a lot of pools in Manhattan, but I don't know. Maybe the Dallas Fed or the Richmond Fed has a pool of gold coins.
I apologize for the dumb questions, but I spent 10 years hosting a NASCAR talk show on ESPN Radio back in the day on some affiliates. And I asked Tony Stewart to smell me once, and he thought it was the best question he's ever been asked. And from then on, I was like, people like questions like that. Got to include them when you're doing a show.
That's I'm a fan. These things can get stale. So
yeah, they can.
I'm a fan. Keep them coming.
Okay, last one. I used to be in the FBI as well.
That's right.
Is there a place in the country that has alien technology?
Not that I know of.
Mm-hmm. And if you told us, would you magically disappear? Like, we'd be gone. We'd be like, where's Jeff?
Instantaneously.
All right, so you're going to keep it to yourself. I get it.
As an optimist, though, I do believe there is life out there in the cosmos. It seems statistically crazy that there wouldn't be. So hopefully one day we find it and meet it.
Jodie Foster said it's be an awfully big waste of space.
It would be.
I agree with you, but I do believe that Bigfoot is not real. I don't believe
I'm with you on that one.
We would have found him by now, people. We got cameras everywhere.
Yeah, those deer trap cams.
Yeah, my neighbor's got five in the woods back here. Yeah,
somebody must that's see right.
Jeff, we covered some really important stuff. I very much enjoyed our chat, and I'm glad you came on. And I'd love to have you on again sometime. And there's always more we can talk about.
I think that'd be amazing. Thank you for having me, Matt. This was great. I appreciated the questions at the end, too. Happy to come back.
Thank you. Jeff Schaefer, head of responsible AI at Booz Allen Hamilton, here on Mostly Marketing with Matt Wilson. People tell me you're supposed to promote your podcast at the end of your podcast. You know, smash the like button, subscribe, yada, yada, yada. It always seems so cheesy to me. So if you want to follow me, then follow me. If not, like, whatever, it's fine. So anyway, more episodes of Mostly Marketing with Matt Wilson coming soon. Thanks for listening. Appreciate it.
Mostly Automotive Marketing with Matt Wilson is brought to you by... Wait, this guy has sponsors? Oh, never mind. This sheet of paper's blank. No sponsors. That makes more sense. For updates, info, future episodes, and more, follow on Twitter, subscribe on YouTube, like on Facebook, and connect on Frackle. You guys made that last one up. That's not even a thing, Frackle. Come on.